listening to the Confessions of a Clairvoyant Housewife podcast. From marriage to menopause and margaritas, nothing is off the table. This is Cindy Goldenberg.
Hi, everyone. This is Cindy Goldenberg, and this is part two of my talk about my own personal journey of self-discovery, or how come we do the things that we do? Why do we react the way that we do? Or, as I'm titling this, "It ain't me, it's you," and other lies we tell ourselves. So, as I was telling you before, after I had my back surgery, one of the things that I had an option of doing was getting counseling. And I thought at first it was because some people get depressed after they have surgery and they're not mobile or they don't get out. And then they just informed me that, no, it's part of your, quote, package that is offered to you as follow-up care. So when I called, I didn't realize I would meet someone who was like this phenomenal teacher, like an instructor of a masterclass that had so many tools and ideas and observations on how to heighten my awareness through cognitive choices and intentional actions that I could match with my psychic intuitive awareness and with my polished emotional intelligence, according to her. In other words, I was telling you that because it is easy for me to be intuitive and to hook into that beautiful, blissful, ascended way of thinking that makes you feel better and lighter, where the energy elevates and you can't feel your feet and you don't know what time of day it is, nor do you care, that part of your brain actually elevates to where you are so knowledgeable about your own emotions and other people's emotions, and that you're very comfortable in feeling all of that, and you have a very developed way of expressing verbally and written how you feel or how things make you feel or observations about what your feelings could do or change outcomes. Whereas instead of understanding how I can turn that part off, or how to get grounded, or how to be objective, she is teaching me to become aware of the part of my brain that needs to act, that needs to move. She told me that when you can find ways, for example, you have a feeling and you can get your chest tight and you get anxious. For example, my counselor told me when you can associate an act, an intention, a movement, a descriptive word that makes you aware of doing something along with a feeling or a reactive emotion, that you are training the other part of your brain to become aware of being in some sort of control. For instance, when the other day I started to feel anxious and angry and hot and flushed and impatient, I closed my eyes, I put my finger up, and I slowly and purposely took a long, quiet, gentle breath. And I just inhaled, and then I just exhaled. And then I began speaking. Now, fortunately, the person I was talking to, and in this instance, it was my husband, who can easily provoke me and we get into a cycle of arguments, he allowed me that time to take a moment to collect myself so I could observe the feelings I was having, the reactions I was having, the trepidation of, oh my God, is this going to happen again? Are we going to go down this rabbit hole? And all those other thoughts and feelings that were flooding me. And instead, I took a beat, a nanosecond, and observed that I was having an anxious feeling, but I chose to breathe and take a moment. And my counselor pointed out that what I was doing was taking a conscious effort to observe the feeling and observe the emotion. And my action was to breathe and simply observe it. So that sounds so simple, right? But we don't do it. So in doing that, she asked me, what did that mean to you? And I said that I can navigate this. That all I need in 24 hours in a day is a nanosecond to put a beat between myself and my reactions and observing them. Just a little distance. So the other things that she explained to me were that we can go through descriptions of words like things that we value, freedom, joy, success, ambition, compassion, things we like in ourselves or in other people, and then write down why that's attractive or fulfilling, and then what is a physical act or intention that would reflect a feeling, which is invisible, right? So what would ambition feel like if you could make it an action? Walking. So I walk towards success and towards my goals. And as I do, they walk towards me. I breathe. As I breathe, I inhale and I accept everything good in life that comes towards me. As I hum, as I listen to music, etc., etc., I am purposely putting an action to the feeling of the integrity or the value that I admire in myself or in others. In other words, I am complimenting the other side of my brain and not just feeling it. Yes, you can still visualize. Yes, you can still say affirmations, but you are purposely saying, I am saying an affirmation right now because I feel this way and I feel blissful and hopeful and I trust and I know it and I like it. But I am saying this because I am imprinting these words to that specific feeling of joy and resilience and responsibility and goal setting or whatever the terms or words that you are using. She also pointed out that don't wait for motivation. Motivation doesn't happen. Sometimes it does. When you get a really good night's rest, you wake up and you go, wow, I'm going to do this. I'm going to vacuum the walls. Then I'm going to go work out at the gym. Then I'm going to write a screenplay. Then I'm going to do a podcast and a short story and go see a movie and eat dinner and, you know, bake a cake. You know, and you do like one or two things, right? But in reality, she told me, action creates motivation. In fact, it's scientifically proven, for instance, walking or doing some kind of exercise regime, it doesn't happen when you get motivated. If you start moving your body 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 5, 50, 60 minutes later, somewhere in there, you get motivated. So motivation is something that isn't a concept or a feeling or a trait that you have to wait for. You have to move. You have to act. You have to breathe. You have to listen to music. You have to be deliberate. You have to be intentional. You have to be specific. You have to know what you want and how you're going to get it and what you're going to say to get it or experience it. But you must act. There must be an action. There must be an action. So I really liked that, and I'm very conscious of that right now. So the other thing that I wanted to share about my own self-discovery is that, again, I know that I am a codependent, an enabler. And ordinarily, we think of that as, oh, yeah, the person that lets her husband drink. No, it's not that simple. I love this book Codependent No More, How to Stop Controlling Others and Start Caring for Yourself. It's a classic. I think it's like 26, 27, 28 years old. And it's written by Melody Beattie. And it is my handbook that I love to teach from, read, and I get inspired. And I get motivated. But I love to just reread a lot of the things that she says. And I bring this up to you because we all have codependent tendencies, traits, behavioral mechanisms, protective mechanisms. But this is what it means to have these behaviors. She says, codependent behaviors or habits are self-destructive. We frequently react to people who are destroying themselves. We react by learning to destroy ourselves. These habits can lead us into or keep us in destructive relationships, relationships that just don't work. These behaviors can sabotage relationships that may otherwise have worked. These behaviors can prevent us from finding peace and happiness with the most important person in our lives, ourselves. So I read this the first time and I go, yeah, I know. Do it for ourselves. Do something for ourselves. Make ourselves a priority. Get some boundaries. Get through the menopausal rage and the anguish and get into the seasoned aging process where you let all the bullshit go, get stronger, get more loving, but get more intolerant and say no. I love you, but I'm not coming to your party. But keep asking because one time I may. Get truthful. Get transparent. Got it. But now that I've put this book down, and now that I'm working with this wonderful psychotherapist, and I'm really learning to understand why my triggers affect me or how they affect me without judging that they do, because we all have them. I'm not worried about that. I've already got the self-forgiveness down pat. But I just don't want to keep living in a situation of predictable frustration. And so in this self-discovery, when I read this again, I go, oh my God, I'm not finding peace and happiness with the most important person in my life. I'm not finding peace in myself. There's something that I'm ignoring. So in her book, Codependent No More by Melody Beattie, she talks about codependent characteristics. She also adds the serenity prayer, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So I feel now in this part of my life that I am invoking the courage to change the things I can, which is myself. So when you look at these and you look at the way that she writes, you know, I love her style of writing because it's very pragmatic. It invokes emotion without being an emotional book. It's very detached, but inviting. She says, most of us started doing these things out of necessity to protect ourselves and meet our needs. We performed, felt, and thought that these things to survive emotionally, mentally, and sometimes physically, we tried to understand and cope with our complex worlds in the best ways. We did the best we could. However, we've been doing the wrong things for the right reasons. Can we learn healthier behaviors? I don't know if mental, spiritual, and emotional health can be taught, but we can be inspired and encouraged, and we can learn to do things differently. I love that. So you don't have to master this. Just be aware of approaching a perspective, an insight, an emotion, a trigger differently. So you know, if I could talk to everybody, I go, try to do something different and not just drive in a different way when you go to work or to the store. But when you think or react to yourself or what you're doing, just become aware. So in this book, she has some lists, and I have so many things highlighted, but here's some things about the codependent and the caretaking. You think and feel responsible for other people, for other people's feelings, thoughts, and actions, choices, wants, needs, well-being, lack of well-being, and ultimate destiny. Yep, that's me. Or, you know, when you do things that you think you're helping people and you want to make them feel better. So you become, quote, responsible, and you feel like you're responsible to help them understand. So now I'm really not responsible for them, but I'm responsible to share the insight that I have. And then I realize the other thing was I'm responsible for telling them how I want to be talked to, or I'm responsible for making myself clear, or I'm responsible to help somebody in a certain situation. And again, my counselor pointed out, listen, responsibility isn't an emotion. It's not a character trait. It's a choice. Stop making the choice. And I thought, oh my God, that's so simple. Back to Codependent No More by Melody Beattie. She says things like, you feel angry when your help isn't effective. And I think, yep, you get real mad that somebody doesn't take your advice, right? Or do what you're telling them to do, because after all, I'm doing it for you. You get the world when you listen to me, because I already know everything. And if you just do it as I tell you to do. She also talks about saying they find themselves saying yes when they mean no, doing things they don't want to do. Well, that's classic. And then you find it easier to feel and express anger about injustices done to others rather than to anything yourself. You feel safe when giving. You find yourself attracted to needy people, or you allow needy people in your sphere because you're so spiritual and forgiving and understanding and compassionate that you know how to take the higher roads, so therefore you do. Another section is low self-worth. You come from troubled, repressed, or dysfunctional families, don't we all? You deny that you're troubled or repressed or dysfunctional. Again, don't we all? You reject compliments or praise. Or you get depressed from a lack of compliments and praise. You feel different from the rest of the world. You think you're not good enough. You feel guilty about spending money on yourself or doing unnecessary or fun things for yourself. You take things personally. You've been a victim of sexual, physical, or emotional abuse, neglect, abandonment, or alcoholism. Sometimes you expect everyone to do everything perfectly. You have a lot of shoulds. You have a lot of guilt. You have a lot of shame. You try to help people live their lives. And then there's another section. You get the gist of what I'm saying. The obsession is to think and talk about other people and abandon your routine because you got to take care of them. And then there's a section on controlling that she writes about, and you become afraid to let other people be who they are and allow events to happen naturally because you can step in and you can prevent it. You try to control events and people through helplessness, guilt, coercion, threats, advice giving, manipulation, or domination. Another part is in denial. You ignore problems or pretend they aren't happening because you got to get the kids to school. You stay busy so you don't have to think about things. You get depressed or sick. You often seek love from people incapable of loving. And maybe not in a relationship, but just even in a friendship, you see that, oh, this person is broken. I'll show them how to love. I'll show them how to receive. I'll be the example. I'll be the way shower. She goes on to write about that you stay in relationships that don't work, or you feel trapped in a relationship. and in communicating, codependents frequently blame, advise, don't say what they mean, don't mean what they say, don't take themselves seriously, or they take themselves too seriously. They gauge their words carefully to achieve a desired effect. Yep, I can relate. They try to say what they think will please people. Yep, that's me. They try to say what they hope will make people do what they want them to do. Yep, yep. Talk too much. Got that. Dang. I wear that well. And a lot of people apologize for bothering people. They also, she writes, have weak boundaries. They let others hurt them. They keep letting people hurt them. They wonder why they hurt so badly. So it goes on and on. There's so many different categories. But the bottom line is, codependents appear to be dependent upon, but they are dependent. They look strong, but they feel helpless, and they feel good when they're helping other people. So her book goes on to explain certain situations that you can see yourself in, and then how to lovingly detach and take care of yourself. So my therapist pointed out to me that a lot or the majority of my needing or enjoying to be in control, and I don't mean control across the board, and I don't mean it in a overt way, like, oh, let me be the boss, let me be the ringleader, let me do this, which I am, but I'm talking about the conversation between me and me in the middle of the night. But I don't like to lose control because of the safety of my children. I think as mothers and parents, a lot of us are natural codependents because we want to protect our child. But when it becomes to the point where we don't let them make their own mistakes or grow up as an adult, and we infringe in their personality or their routine, and without proper communication or forgiveness or observation, it can go awry. And I understand that. But the control that I'm feeling is a quiet need to feel secure, because it's up to me. I can create my own safety net if I know the perimeters, if I know the boundaries, and if I know the players. And she said, a lot of this comes from you parenting your parents. It's called parentification. Parentified children are where the roles are reversed. The child takes care of the parent. Now, when I was young, like I said, I was raised by a very outgoing, loving, demonstrative, over-the-top, gregarious, adventurous father, an ex-Marine. And I lived in Southern California in a lovely tract home with friends and bicycles and hopscotch and all the latest 1960s toys. But when I look at a lot of the things that are shameful or embarrassing, you find a common thread with so many other people: alcoholism, enabling, codependency, denial. My father was an alcoholic, but he wasn't like when I was young. He was just violent and angry and needy. But I loved him, and he cuddled me, and he made me feel like the most wonderful person in the world. And he was strong, and he was fearless, and he could do no wrong until he hit my mom and until he lost control. And he was volatile, and we knew, heads down, be quiet, get through it, next. And it's not as bad as a lot of other people, so you grow up and go, it's not as bad. Other people have it worse. But when I look and think, gee, one minute I'm in my home in Huntington Beach, Southern California. And my mom and dad were physically separated because he was getting work in a little rural area outside of Seattle. And my grandmother, who was a narcissist and a drug addict and a businesswoman who packed guns and had a business in East LA. And my mother grew up artistic and creative and beautiful, like a glamorous model. And in fact, she did model. And she lived in Hollywood and she was independent and she took streetcars. And she realized at a young age that she had to create her own life, regardless of her mother, because her mom would plant her face in a bowl of cereal after taking too many pills. But she was also a workaholic and a drama queen, amongst other things, and married a string of alcoholic men, one right after another. But it didn't faze my mom, didn't faze her beauty, didn't faze her love for me, didn't faze her creativity. And I admired that, and I still do as I look back and reflect. But growing up, there was an argument, and one minute I was in that home, and the next minute my mom's mother, my grandmother had a gun, and this man that was with her who drove her from LA down to Huntington Beach from her business of a dry cleaning shop, he had a gun. And my dad went down to the neighbors and he had a gun. And a gunfight ensued because they were mad. They were angry. My dad wanted my mom to come back with him. My grandmother didn't want him to interfere. And she wanted to be in control and take over the house and et cetera. Who cares? But at 10 years old, I thought, really? And I remember that night, I know I had to be scared, but I don't remember feeling fear. I just remember being pragmatic and alert. And I sat with my mother on a closet floor, and as they screamed, my grandmother and my father screamed at each other and shot bullets into the ceiling. I remember one going through the closet, which was a very thin piece of wood, because the little particles came down and floated in front of my face. So it wasn't right near my head, but I thought close enough if I were standing up. But in my mind at that young age, I thought, this is bullshit, chicken shit. I can't believe that I am part of this world. I don't know why it has to be this way. They're all so immature. You're really not going to kill each other, or go out in the open and just do it. But either way, one or the other, this is so ridiculous. So I thought like that, even though I didn't have the words. And then eventually somebody opened the door and there was arguments in the living room. And then police showed up and an ambulance. And apparently my dad did almost kill and shoot this man. But the gun didn't go off. The driver, my grandmother's friend. And I remember he was fine sitting down and someone was putting a bandage on him and they walked him out. And then he wasn't my grandfather because I never knew my grandfather. He died when my mom was young. And I don't remember the other grandfather when I was little because I was too young and he was kind to my mom, but he was an alcoholic. But this man was an alcoholic and he was weird and slimy and greasy and ugh. And he came downstairs and he had white foam in his mouth that it was as sticky as two cotton balls in the corner of his mouth. And he had dark gray nubs all over his pockmarked face and oily hair. And he was in a drunken stupor in his maroon silk, pimp pajamas. And I thought, you disgust me. And then I saw him holding a gun in his hand while he stumbled around the corner into the kitchen. And that was the first time I felt a diarrhea feeling of fear that something could go wrong. And I remember calmly walking down the hall and then my grandmother with me and going into the bathroom and locking the door. And I have to laugh because it's a tract home and the little tiny door lock, like, you really think you're going to keep somebody out? They could push the door open. Anyway, I've talked to too many people with similar kind of issues of, you know, family negotiations and quabbles and gunfights, like, hello. But we stayed all night at a neighbor, and the next day, my dad, whatever he did, you know, went to jail for a night. I don't know. We packed up the car. He got a small U-Haul, and we got a few things and a suitcase, and we started driving up California, and our destination was to get to where his business partner, another contractor, because my father built homes, about an hour out of Seattle in a suburb. And so we drove up and we had my dog that I had had since I was born. And he was 10 years old, the same as me. And we drove and we stayed in little hotels or motels. And then I remember being up in the Northwest and it was raining. It was October. And any of you know the Pacific Northwest, it rains 3,000 days out of the year. I mean, it rains day and night. And we went to a gas station and my dad was sopping wet. We didn't really have parkas or anything else. And he opened the door to get back in the car and our dog, this beautiful black Cocker Spaniel mix, got out. And I was beyond words. I had just lived through this stupid, ridiculous incident. And everything that I loved, from the sunshine to little bikinis and Sonny and Cher music on my record player and my friends and my bicycle and my hopscotch, was gone. But my dog that I love so much got out of the car. My dad ran and looked for him and called and whistled, and he came back in and he goes, he'll come back. Dogs can find their way. And we drove. And I remember thinking, I can't cry. I'm so stunned. But in meditation on multiple times, I know that was a point in my life where I had a soul contract to never be not in control again. That I would be in control the rest of my life, as much and to the best ability I could, that I would never be in a vulnerable situation. I would know the players, I would know the perimeters, I would know the boundaries, and I would know everyone involved, what they do, and how it plays out. So in a lot of ways, as we all know, whatever we've lived through made us strong and gave us great characteristics of surviving. And also, as a dog lover and dog owner, I know as dogs get older and they get tumors, they want to run away. They want to escape because they know they're at the end of their life. And being spiritual and clairvoyant, I know that they live on and they're with us forever. But when I was 10, I did not know. But I tell you that story about control. So I've accepted that part of myself, but it made me strong. It made me relentless. It made me specific. It made me determined. It made me fearless and confident. And I thought, I got nothing to lose and everything to gain, and I can accomplish anything I want. But it didn't happen that quick at age 10. I had to endure a few more years of living in a substandard way. Thank God I could come back to Southern California every summer and see friends and family and have some sense of normalcy. But in the meantime, what happened was I became the parent. So I found this article in Psychology Today, 14 Signs You Were Parentified as a Child, or How to Heal Your Inner Child. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's by Whitney Goodman. And she talks about that parentification is when a child is forced to take on the role of an adult. And it occurs across a spectrum, and there's many different levels of hurt that develop. There's different qualities. And, you know, we're not all exactly the same. But the bottom line is that it becomes catastrophic for a child in their adult self. And I think, okay, I'll read that. Now it makes sense. I don't really know what's catastrophic in my life, but maybe there's something catastrophic in me that's preventing me from healing. So she says, here are a few signs. You grew up feeling like you had to be responsible. Check. Trouble with play or letting loose. Yep. I just knew, you know, like I was the mature one. The next one is you like to feel in control. I love that because it doesn't say you need to be in control. It says you like to be in control. Double check that. You're pulled into arguments or issues between caregivers. Yep. You felt like you were given responsibilities that were not appropriate for someone your age. I don't know so much about that. I didn't have 10,000 siblings that I had to take care of. I just knew that somebody had to remain balanced. The other signs are you often compliment for being so good and so responsible. Oh, yes. Plus, I was very tall. At 13, I was 5'10", so I was an adult. I could drink cocktails at the racetrack. So I always felt like a grown-up. The other point she makes is you may feel that being self-reliant is better than trying to trust others. Wow, you got that right. The other one is you don't really remember being a kid. I was in Huntington Beach. I was the ringleader. I was the tallest. Everybody followed me. I had the prettier bike and the better jungle gym in the backyard. I liked playing teacher, but I had a group of friends and I loved playing, and then it ended. The other point, she says, is often find yourself becoming a caregiver for others. Yeah. Being a caretaker feels good, even when you're sacrificing parts of yourself. And I say amen to that, especially when you're sacrificing parts of yourself. That martyr, that, oh my God, I've got to do this. Next one is heightened sense of empathy, which makes you intuitive, which makes you insightful. Also an ability to be more closely connected with others. You feel like you need to be a peacemaker. Yes. And the zinger, you feel like your efforts aren't appreciated. Yes, and the family gets to hear that. So she basically says, how do you get in touch with your inner child? You become aware and accept that you have an inner child. And you listen to the voice, you get to know what the child's needs are. You take responsibility of reparenting yourself. It's okay to say it wasn't fair and to wish it was different, but the only way to move forward is to say, I'm going to take it from here. I am my own hero. I don't need to live this way anymore. That's basically what Viola Davis's book is about, Finding Me. Of how she learned to talk to her inner child and set herself free. So it's a great article, but I just thought I'd share with you those points that every single one I can relate to. So like I say, my counselor pointed out to me that I always grew up feeling that I was 100% responsible for everyone. She pointed out to me that this kind of trait, these kind of people feel deeply, deeply hurt when they cannot save someone or rescue someone or help someone. And these are the little conversations that I have between me and me in the middle of the night. The urge of why does there have to be war? Why is there conflict? It's so easy to love. It's so easy to feel and be the light. And why not give of yourself to help someone else? But what she was saying is There is no way to compare because this is so uncommon, this deep pain. And I said, yeah, I guess it is. It's kind of abnormal. And she said, no, it's not abnormal. It's uncommon. Because that pain and that hurt, it's so deep. And it's because, you see, parents don't depend on the emotional needs from the child, but the child depends on emotional needs from the adult. And if the caregiver isn't available to do that because they are burdened with an alcoholic spouse or they are an enabler in denying themselves, she said, that need in you to know that you deserve to be heard and fulfilled and the center of the light of joy, that part of you never gets fulfilled. And therefore, you never show up asking for your own needs. You only do it for others. And that is the core, she explained to me, of who I am. And that if the core of who I am can't show up for myself, then I'm not asking, I'm not feeling, and I'm not approachable. That part of me, that train track of all these things that want to come to me, they can't get to me. And she says, so when you are not living the true core of your life where you are showing up for yourself, then we live contrary to our values. And therefore, the word that you wrote down that is your highest value is freedom. That you do not have freedom. And that's what you relish the most. The spontaneity. The joy. The reverence. The fun. The adventure. And all of a sudden, it clicked. I thought, yep, I feel trapped. I feel angry. I feel upset that I'm in a relationship that I chose my entire adult life in a cyclical argument over petty things that get triggered by a personality disorder or not. But I get it. And like she told me before, and I told you in the previous podcast, any pain and suffering that is not acknowledged and healed, that is not resolved, keeps cycling back stronger, more consistently, and becomes louder and louder and louder. So this parentification, I am now open to reading about, discovering, and applying to parts of my life, and I'm working on it through art, through writing, through inner child work. And what I've learned is that this is a form of invisible childhood trauma. It's mental abuse. And it's a boundary violation because the child sacrifices his or her needs for attention, comfort, and guidance for someone else, like a parent or a sibling. A lot of times I've read that the parent is sometimes mental, like with depression, or they complain, or they have trauma, but they're also the child is raised around alcoholism or a disability or abuse, or they're responsible for adult chores and responsibilities, things a child shouldn't have to be, or a lot of times looking out after younger children. So it isn't like there's a right or wrong. Obviously, the alcoholism, the abuse, and you know, things that are very evident, we all know the damage that that can incur. But what these things do is they deprive the time of the child to create play, and experience fun, like joy and freedom. And when I read that, I thought, wow, I'm in the right place. I am digging into areas of myself that I didn't know were there. So with me, I have control issues. Like I told you, I made a soul contract to be in control. I have relationship difficulties. And I've always said 100%, it ain't me, it's you. It ain't me, I got this. It's gotta be you, because it ain't me. I have poor boundaries. And I see a lot of these unfortunate habits in my own children. Not proud, but they're smart and they're resilient and they're young and they don't have to live a life to unlearn everything they thought they knew to get to where they are now. So I have hope. But back to me. The other one is a lot of anxiety. I'm not an anxious person. I don't get anxiety, but when I get it, it's over being provoked. So it's only one thing. There's only one button that I have that sends me to the moon. So the things that she is reminding me to do is to get in touch with my inner child and become more aware through self-discovery. So one of the things I find very interesting are portions of this book, Complex PTSD, From Surviving to Thriving by Pete Walker. This is another classic. It is all about complex post-trauma, but more about the personality characteristics and protective mechanisms. So we call it trauma, but trauma can be just being hurt, being bullied, having a emotional flashback of something that hurts your feelings. It doesn't always have to be like in the movies where it's like abuse or neglect or alcoholism. So if you can read the book and enter, you know, a different word for trauma and just realize that all of us do harmful behaviors. What do you mean harmful? We hurt other people? No, like I said, or like Melody Beattie said in Codependent No More, we are sabotaging the best relationship with the best person, ourself. So we are doing harmful behaviors to ourselves because we're defensive, because we're using all these mechanisms. We're covering up the pain. We don't want to look. We don't want it to come up. That's what I keep saying to my husband, like, just let it out. Get the right kind of therapy. Don't be afraid. Don't judge. You're broken. There's no shame in that. It's not your fault, but it's your fault that you're not doing anything about it. So now I'm stopping. I'm not fixing, but I'm looking in myself too. And this book, From Surviving to Thriving, Complex PTSD, Pete Walker talks about the four Fs. And the four Fs are our protective mechanisms. They are fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. In this book, he has a couple charts. So the positive characteristics of the four Fs are like this. Under fight, if you had to fight, and you still fight to this day, but you're antagonistic or you're quick response or hot temper, it comes from a protective mechanism growing up to survive. And what it really did is it brought you assertiveness, boundaries, courage, moxie, or having balls, right? And leadership. These are all good traits. But as we get older, and we fixate and we keep doing these things, and now years go by, decades go by, and we're now like living the life of this nagging voice of critic and painful feelings behind it in our conscious and our subconscious over and over and over and over again. And we're triggered over and over and over again. And we have emotional flashbacks that we don't know where they're coming from. And we don't know why. And we're trying to figure it out over and over and over again. So the detrimental characteristics of fight are narcissistic tendencies or narcissistic defense behaviors, which is gaslighting, arguing, provoking, being explosive, controlling to the point of enslaving. And it doesn't have to be real loud and abusive. It's just, I got you where I want you and you're trapped. Entitlement, or a type A personality, or a bully, or an autocrat, like a dictator, my way or the highway. Or a person that demands perfection, or a sociopath, or a conduct disorder. So it doesn't mean if you started out using fighting and arguing as a defense because you didn't want to have people get close, because you're using it as a self-sabotaging tool, because you're protecting yourself from your childhood pain, is going to necessarily turn you into a type A bully, dictator, sociopath. But it could. The other positive characteristics of flight, which means running away. So if you used it as a defense mechanism growing up, it was disengagement. Healthy retreat. It was disengagement. Healthy retreat. Industriousness, meaning being creative or knowing what to do and being okay with being alone. Know-how and perseverance. So a lot of my time is spent looking at these books, and I sit and I talk about it with my husband. And I say, look at all these wonderful traits that you are. And when you were a child and what you had to deal with, look what you did. You became very industrious. You became very creative. You had a healthy disengagement. You persevered. You have a lot of autonomy. So the detrimental characteristics of flight, obsessive compulsive. Yep, he's got that. Panicky. Yep. Rushing or worrying, which really means you're trying to outrun the pain. Yep, yep. That's his middle name. Drivenness. Yes. Adrenaline junkie. Maybe not him, but I do see this in other people. Busyholic. Micromanager. Compelled by perfectionism. Mood disorder like bipolar. And ADHD. That's definitely my husband. Freeze, the positive characteristic of freeze. When you're young and you're doing the best you can, you may use freeze as your defense protective mechanism. It creates acute awareness, mindfulness, poised readiness, peace, and presence. Boy, that's me. That's me. I was ready. I was serene. I was in command, I was aware, and I was poised for the next shoe to drop. But as you see, when you wear it over and over, as you get older, now the detrimental characteristic of freeze is disassociative, contracting, hiding, camouflaging, isolation, couch potato, space case, hermit, achievement phobic, schizophrenic, and ADD. I don't really see myself in too many of those, but I do understand how that could manifest. And the last one is fawning. So the positive characteristic of fawning is love and service, compromise, listening, fairness, and peacemaking. I can identify with all that. But the detrimental characteristic of fawning is codependent, servitude, groveling, loss of self, people pleaser. Well, I'm all those. Doormat. I don't think so, but in a lot of instances, I turn into the child when my father is violent and I look at the floor and get through it. A slave. I felt that way. Social perfectionism. I can identify with that. Feeling like a victim. Yes. And the parentified child. Bingo. There I am on page 107. So I share with you my ongoing process of understanding where my habits, my pain, and my defenses come from. And I do so because I find the process interesting and fascinating. I would never do this to anybody else because I'm too caring and it's private and I would never exploit anybody's personal journey. But this is my personal journey. And I am, like many of you, very intuitive, very much an empath, very sensitive, and very caring. And I will not and refuse and do not want to condemn or change any of those qualities. So as I share this with you, I will come back to this in the future and give you an update of how I'm doing. But in the same time, I encourage you to become aware of what your actions can be in order to imprint an opposite reaction of fear, of fawning, of flight. So what I have learned for myself is to incorporate actions. And if I use a word like safety or an affirmation that I am safe and that I do not have to respond to every provocation, I do not have to protect myself from being hurt, because in doing so, it increases my suffering. And by avoiding my suffering, I wallow in anger. I submerge myself in rage. So I realize that this emotional trigger is not necessary. So I write things like this to myself and I read them. So she said to me, as you become aware of your triggers, your emotional triggers, you know you can avoid the whole thing. But when you do use avoidance, it's with a cost, because you're just repeating that button of a rinse and repeat cycle. Or you become aware in that second, in that moment, and you become aware that you're capable of becoming aware. And it's always without condemnation. And then learn to make contact with this emotional awareness and stay with it. Get riled up, get nervous, get hot, get angry, whatever it is. Stay with it and make a conscious choice. Do I avoid or do I stay with the emotion through acceptance? And I bring in my value-based actions and emotions of freedom, of joy, of success, and the words that I've picked out that mean something to me. So when you do this, you're realizing and teaching yourself that everything you need, every soothing tonic that you need from the trauma and the suffering and the pain and the experiences and the behaviors that you've witnessed as a child, and I believe in this life or in another life, you can't look for safety from another person, but you can look for it in yourself because it's there. And so with this practice of awareness, of pressing that button of I can stay with this, and I can accept it, and I can apply an action or a thought because my safety comes from me. That is the ultimate control. And that is a healthy way of realizing that you are made of potential to heal and redirect your neurotransmitters in your brain and in your heart, your energy. You can put it on the parts that are ready to receive. So stop looking at other people to blame. Stop blaming yourself. Identify your patterns, identify your triggers, and learn to love all parts of yourself, including the inner child. Realize that your joy and your happiness does not come from other people's approval of you, nor does your happiness come from you taking care of other people. That everything you need, every mirror and every tool and every tonic exists inside you. We all get a little off balance, or we all get a little used to doing what we do best and ignoring the rest, right? We all brush the front of our hair and forget to do the back. So it's okay to recalibrate and to reignite an interest and self-discovery. So thank you for listening, and I hope that my own journey has inspired you to do the same. And I will keep you updated, but in the meantime, I'm excited, I'm motivated, I'm aware, and I am capable and committed to doing this.
You have been listening to the Confessions of a Clairvoyant Housewife podcast with intuitive expert Cindy Goldenberg. To learn more or stay connected, be sure to visit www.cindygoldenberg.com.